Support for Level Up Language Podcast comes from Davis School District and Clearfield High School. Hope you enjoy, and thank you for listening. The last few episodes, we focused on proficiency and the actual standards that we follow here in the district. We discussed each of the modalities, writing, speaking, listening, reading, and what we want our students to do, or what our students are expected to do within each of these modalities. The big question is, how do we now use that information? And this podcast is going to focus on the practical ways in which we try to achieve those standards within the language classroom. We want to give you a snapshot inside our classrooms as we discuss what we do as teachers to guide students to higher levels of proficiency. So we have the standards, we have the can-do statements, we have the expectations. Now we want to talk about the instruction. How do we channel this knowledge, these theories, and the actual standards into classroom instruction? To clarify, we are not bragging, nor are we claiming to be expert teachers. We are simply trying to succeed every day in getting our students to be more proficient in the language. Some days we fail, and some days we succeed. Each day we just try to fail better. And with that, let's get into Level Up. Welcome to tonight's episode. I'm your host, Davin Lemke, joined with the other hosts of this podcast, Roger Burt, Miles Nance, and Brandon Welker. As discussed in the introduction, we are going to talk about the inside of our classroom. We're going to talk about what the instruction looks like, how we try to achieve those actual standards. Just to give you an overview of the setup of our classrooms in Davis School District, generally every school we have is set up for about 85 minutes, give or take. So every high school and most of our junior high schools teach for around 85 minutes. The students have 8 classes. We're on an A-B schedule, so they have 4 classes one day, 4 classes the next day. And one of the main targets that we try to hit or standards that we have for the teachers is that we maintain 90% language usage. In other words, the teachers have to use the language 90% of the time when they're instructing, helping students, and things like that. It has to be a minimum of 90% instruction. So what we want to do is give you as an observer, give you an idea, a visual of if you were to come observe our classroom, what would you see in that 85 minutes that we have to teach? So I'm going to start with the beginning. At the very beginning of class, when those students walk in, it's often emphasized as part of teaching pedagogy and in all of our trainings that the first couple minutes are some of the most important ones we have when students come into the classroom. So how do we immediately jump into language learning? If they're coming from a math class or an English class, and the second they come sit in our classroom, what do we do to immediately engage them and transition them into thinking in the target language, whether that's French, Spanish, German, or Chinese, or any other? So to give you an example, in my classroom, the way we start out is because we still have to take attendance, and there's some kids asking questions about homework or whatever, I'll have a few questions up on the board when the students walk in. The questions are in the target language. Students come in, they sit down, they pull out their notebooks, and they're called their starters. They'll have a section in their notebook called starters. And the questions are simply questions from previous lessons, previous material. So previous structures, previous vocab, previous themes. And I'll only have about 4 or 5 questions. Should only take them about 3 or 4 minutes. They read the question, they answer it in a complete sentence in Spanish. Out of the 5 questions, I'll usually do 3 or 4 that are going to be really easy. They're questions straight out of last class period's lesson plan or something that I know they've seen before. And then usually for 1 or 2 questions, I'll try to challenge them a little bit. I won't give them too hard of a question, but I will maybe change the wording a little bit, kind of reverse the question or take something that maybe we haven't practiced for quite a while and somehow bring it into the conversation just to get them to really think about the language and try to level up or expand on their proficiency. That gets them transferred into the language. They're writing the language. They're reading the language. We'll do a quick passover. I'll ask the students to just call out some answers as I go around. I'll just call their name and ask them a question. They'll respond and might give some instruction or some guidance. But for the most part, I just want to hear what their responses were. And then I'll have them stand up, find their clock partner, which I mentioned before. Each student is assigned to 6 different partners. And I'll say, a las tres. And they'll stand up, they'll find the 3 o'clock partner, and they'll just ask each other those questions. So then they also get introduced to the speaking very early on. So right away from the beginning, I've done a reading, I've done a writing, and I've done a speaking. So that's just a general idea of how my classroom starts to get them thinking in the language. So I'm going to turn it over to the other hosts to tell us, as an, what would an observer see when they came into your classroom in the first 5 to 10 minutes, and what's the focus of those first 5 to 10 minutes? I'm going to start with Roger.
In my classroom, the first 5 to 10 minutes, as students are coming in from the bell, I have a meme up on the screen for kids to look at and laugh at if they get it. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But just to kind of break the ice, have a little something humorous to look at. I think I got that from Tom Matthews at Weber State. He was always really good at having something funny on the screen when you'd walk in. So from there, as soon as the bell rings, I greet the class in Spanish and just see how everyone's doing. And if anyone says something out of the ordinary, like, oh, I'm okay, or not that great, after I ask how are you doing, if someone says not great, I figure they have the guts to say that in class, so I'm going to ask them about it and say, oh no, class, so-and-so's not doing so great today. And say, well, why aren't you doing so great? And just kind of find a way to laugh a little bit about something. Even if they're not doing great, we'll find a way to kind of cheer them up a little bit and laugh about it. Then we move on to our word of the day. We mentioned it in one of the previous podcasts, either episode 2 or 3. Brandon and I were talking about those little words, the cohesive devices that you need, but they don't really fit smoothly into the curriculum. So we have to be creative with the ways that we introduce them, because we want to do it through context, but where it's not directly connected to anything in the curriculum, it's sometimes hard. So I'll have a cohesive device, a word, a linking word on the board, and I will just provide an example using that word, make an example that's very clear, very obvious for the kids to see what that would be in English. If I have concerns or if some of them look a little confused, then I'll just ask them, en inglés, ¿qué es this word? And then someone will say what it is and say, oh, okay, yeah, very good. Think about an example while I go take care of roll. And so then they'll write down their examples. At least I encourage them to write it down so that, like Davin was saying, they can write it and see it and all those things. I write my example on the board. And then as soon as I finish roll, I have a couple of dice or die that I get, and then I'll toss one out. And that indicates the row that I'm going to be choosing from. And then I'll toss the other one out, and that's the seat, because I have a 6x6 classroom set up. And then we'll ask that student to give their example, and they might need a minute, and that's fine. If they do, then we'll just tell them we'll come back to you in a few minutes. And then we'll have them toss the die, and we'll go around for a few minutes and just get 5 or 6 examples so that we can see that students have got that down. Then we start to transition into the lesson that we've got for the day, but that's about the first 5 to 10 minutes of my classroom.
For me, I would copy a lot from Davin and Roger, what they do. I do a lot of that as well. Not every day with the journals. I did my first couple of years. Every day they'd have a journal, but not as much anymore. They have it randomly throughout the year. Aside from that, my favorite days are Monday, Tuesday, and then also Thursday, Friday. So Wednesday is kind of poopy. But those are my favorite days, because I really love to ask the students what they do over the weekend. I tell them about my weekend and whether the Jazz won or lost, or sad to say, my 49ers lost again, unfortunately. But so they start to learn, you know, what I like and what I don't like. And even my level one students, I'll ask them what they did over the weekend, and it takes them a little bit to understand what I'm asking. But they don't respond in French yet, because they don't know enough to respond, but they know what I'm asking. And I'm fine with them responding in English with that. They may say, oh, I worked. And a lot of these students have jobs, so I'll recast that and say, oh, you work, but in French. And eventually they'll start to pick some of those things up, some of the students. If they don't, that's okay. But I think, to me, that's a smooth transition from whatever the class they had before, or maybe it's the first class of the day for them. I feel like it's a smooth transition to get back into French.
It seems like a very safe and comfortable way of getting the students to transition
pressure,
to your
it's
room.
Nice and safe, just... We do that. They do it all the time. Monday, at least I think they do. Hey, what'd you do over the weekend? They probably do it by Snapchat or text message. But it's a normal conversation that people have. So I think it helps them get into it. And they know from day to day, at least on the first part and the end of the week. At the end of the week, I don't ask them what they did over the weekend. Obviously, it's a little too late for that. I'll ask them, what are they going to do for the weekend? What plans do they have? Especially if it's a longer week and we've got breaks coming up, I'll kind of get in that. What do you guys do for Thanksgiving? Or what do you celebrate winter holidays? I don't force my winter holidays upon them. I ask which ones they celebrate. We'll talk about all of them that they bring up. But just to see what they're doing, just to talk about their lives. And then from there, we dive into new stuff mixed with old stuff, like Davin had mentioned. We don't want to just dive right into new stuff. I try to soften it with things they've already been talking about.
So if I can jump in real quick, I like what Miles mentioned about bringing up things from our own lives and things like that, where you talk about what you did over the weekend, what you're going to do over the weekend. I try to personalize a lot of things too. I kind of forgot that until you mentioned that. But for our word of the day, for example, I like 95% of the time incorporate the Raiders into the word of the day. So the kids know that I love the Raiders, that they have been just pathetically awful for 15 years. And so they poke fun at me. They have fun with me. But I really think that that helps lower the affective filter.
It's probably for another podcast, but maybe it's the Bay Area. 49ers and Raiders just haven't been doing well.
I was going to say that's good. That's modeling that it's okay to make mistakes.
Right. And that's what we want.
That's what we want.
And to have fun with the language and with other people, as long as it's not personal.
Well, I'm the last to go. You guys took all the good ideas, so.
Because you haven't been doing any of this yet.
Actually, yeah. Yeah, mine looks like I'm usually under the desk for the first 10 minutes until someone sounds really worried, and I'll come out. Most of my evaluations are like, come out from under the desk a little sooner. Actually, I was just going to point out that this is, I think, going to be great for us, or great for me anyway, because I've been writing down ideas that you guys talk about each episode, just because, I mean, in three people that have mentioned something, they've all been a little bit different. And I'll admit right now that I feel like my greatest fear is that I'm not creative enough as a teacher. And so I'm constantly copying from other people. But what I do for warm-ups, I do a warm-up also. Usually I've tried to differentiate it a little bit more. So I will usually put up, like Roger said, some kind of, what do we call them, cohesive devices, or level up words, I call them casually in my class, things that help the kids enrich their sentences. And I'll differentiate by putting like two of them up there and then challenge them to write, you know, a sentence with one, a sentence with the other, and then see who can do it with both and try to put them in there and just kind of, you know, I don't know, challenge the deeper thinkers or the kids that like to be silly and put things together, even if they don't really make sense, you know, like a because and an although, and make it a little more challenging. So, and I don't require them to do that, but as far as the warm-up goes, they need to at least try one of the two words.
And keep in mind, and we always have to remember that the first 5 minutes are challenging. This year I made a goal to be outside my door, or at least by the door as students are coming in, so I can say, hola, buenos dias, ¿cómo estás? Just to get them thinking about it. Also make them feel comfortable, kind of break the ice a little bit with something like that. Whereas I remember my first 2 years, I was usually behind the desk just because your first 2 years, you're just scrambling to make sure everything's ready and you know where everything is and your technology works. So now that I'm a little bit more comfortable and calm, I try more now to focus on the kids. The second that bell rings, I'm out from behind the desk and starting in. Like Brandon mentioned, we've got four of us here. We all do it differently, and there's nothing wrong with that, and that's great. And this part of this discussion is just to have ideas thrown out there. Hey, this is what I do. This is what works. This is what I struggle with. Hopefully you can take something that you can use in your own classroom, improve it, make it better, change it, copy, whatever you want to do. We're all trying, and the benefit is hopefully that this podcast and other things that we do is to help the students, is we get take ideas from each other and like, oh, that's a good idea. I'm going to try that in my classroom. And ultimately we just hope that it benefits the students. The next part we want to talk about is the actual instruction. So usually 5 to 10 minutes, we're warming the students up. We have them maybe practice or kind of recycle some of the material from before. We break the ice like Miles does, making them feel comfortable, getting them to start reading, writing, and thinking in the target language. For the most part, as far as instruction goes, one of the main focuses we have, at least in the district, is that we have to do a lot of circling. I'll use that word. But you need to repeat it a lot. Students need to hear it a lot. And so the model that I think a lot of us use, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, I think we do a lot of the I do, we do, and then you do. So they can see how you do it as a teacher, and then you do it together. And so all the students are succeeding and failing at the same time, but then they're all comfortable with each other. And then you kind of set them loose to see what they can do on their own. This year, I've specifically adapted that model to make sure every single one of my classes is after the starter. After the warm-up practice, I've tried to do every class where we start in with new instruction, and then the downtime is when we all practice together and we bring in the old stuff and we mix it in together to increase it. And at the very end, usually the last 10 to 20 minutes of class is when I'll do a you do. I'll do a listening or a writing or something a focus on one of the modalities where the students can practice everything we've done, but by themselves, so I can see what they did on their own. So what we want to talk about is maybe some things not to do in a proficiency-based classroom, and then we want to talk about some things that we should be doing in a proficiency-based classroom. And specifically, we'd like to focus on the actual standards when it comes to the four modalities, but we also want to focus on actual practices, like actual activities and stuff like that. So, Miles, to start with you, what are some things that you think we should avoid during instruction regarding teaching to the actual standards?
My first thought is, why'd you pick me to talk about what not to do?
You explained that on a podcast going out to everybody in the world?
You're in the basement. I'm on the third floor. How do you know what I do in my class? How do you know I do what I'm not supposed to?
I just know you, Miles.
All right, what not to do, and I just kind of came up with a couple of quick bullet points here. First, when it comes to the actual proficiency guidelines, and even all the way up into AP testing and AP grading, nowhere in there does it explicitly say students have to be able to conjugate these many verbs. When you get into intermediate, they have to start using different tenses, like past tenses and future tense, different time frames. But it doesn't say they're perfect. It doesn't say they do it all the time. Just that they make references to these different time frames. So one of the things that I would say that you need to try to avoid is the explicit or direct instruction of grammar. Now that comes with, for me, that comes with some caveats. I don't know if I can jump and talk about things to do, but those explicit grammar instructions, I try to hold off on those until towards the end of the unit where they already had time to think about and process and use them. Now we try to focus a little bit more on them because they've hopefully acquired some of those. But the explicit instruction of grammar at the front or in the middle of lessons, in the middle of your units, I think we need to try to avoid that. And it's not easy, especially if you've been teaching a while and you're new to the proficiency game. It's not an easy jump to no more grammar. That's you know, it's worked. There's always a time and place. And for me personally, I think that is towards the end of a unit. Because again, they've already seen it and they used it. So, but that gets into what we should do, hopefully. Another thing that came up is just too much too soon. You don't give the students enough time to process. Maybe for example, my level twos, I'm introducing the past tense. They're not expected to use it. I just use it all the time myself when we talk about what we like to do, what I like to do. I don't want to jump from there and then let's do the future tense as well and all these other different tenses. I don't want them to go crazy with, what's he talking about now? And that goes back to the grammar instruction where they're worried too much about that they've got too many filters in front of their brain, in front of their mouth, whatever you want to call it, where they can't produce anything because they have those grammar lenses on. Oh, I got to use the past tense here. Or I got to use the am parfait, not the passé composé. I've got to, which future am I using? The near future, the future for you. What am I doing? They're too worried about that as opposed to just doing it, just doing something. And then it's kind of along with that. They need time to practice and to work. There's the quote. I see it on quite a few teachers' doors here. And I know a lot of teachers use this quote and I think it's fantastic. And it's by, I'll just read the quote first. And most of you probably know this. Tell me and I forget. Teach me and I remember. Involve me and I learn. That's by Benjamin Franklin. Just quoted here by Miles Nance. but they need time. Yes, we need to tell them things. We need to try to teach them things, but they need time to be involved and to practice at these different skills, these different things that we're trying to address. And without that time, with cutting that time short, that you do portion, if we cut that too short, the students aren't going to be able to acquire the language and remember it longer term.
Yeah. So you hit on an aspect of language teaching that I think is kind of a strategy that a lot of people use, and it's the conjugation. Like, it is hard to get away from conjugation because we feel like, it just drives me nuts to see that on paper and like nothing gets conjugated or everything gets conjugated into the one, into the yo or the I form, things like that. And then that becomes worksheets where we have almost like a close reading, except we give them the verb in its infinitive form. And then a blank, and we say, conjugate these correctly, and maybe we'll have the conjugation chart up on the board or something. And that is a skill, but it's not proficiency. That's more of an achievement. It's what we know about the language, but it's not really getting us to show what we can do with the language. what we can do with the language would be something much more like giving a contextualized scenario. And instead of going to have them conjugate everything into the past tense in this close reading that's all about holiday celebration from last year, I'm going to give them a scenario and say, this holiday is coming up. You decide, or you're talking with a friend about how much you like this holiday and what you did last year. You decide to tell your friend what you did last year to celebrate the holiday, what you received, what you gave, what you whatever, that's all clearly past tense relevant. But now there's a context with it, and students are invited to take their shots. And what we really need to be doing is modeling those things. And instead of going crazy when we see that they can't conjugate anything or that they're very limited in their conjugation, just give them chunks. Just teach them one or two forms and hammer those. For example, with my level threes the other day, we did Pictionary, and I had them draw things that they used to like when they were kids. And I wrote on the top of the board, when I was a kid, I liked to, and then at the bottom of the board in a different color, I wrote, when you were a kid, you liked to. And so then on their teams, as the student was drawing whatever it was that they liked to do as a child, the students on their team who were answering would say in Spanish, when you were a child, you liked to, and then they would fill in the blank with their words. So they're learning that chunk. Cuando tú eras niño, niña, te gustaba jugar basketball, something like that. And then I introduced the next chunk, and after a few rounds, and then we transitioned from when I was a kid, I liked to when I was a kid, I liked to blank. Now I prefer to blank. And they would have to draw two pictures. And so they got those chunks. And then little by little, I would erase a little bit more of each part of the sentence of the now I prefer. And then I would erase some of the when I was a child. And so they start using those chunks. And it was amazing. That was the last time I taught level three. Today, they were referencing those things a lot. And some of it was incorrect, but some of it was spot on. And I introduced another part today, and they started incorporating that a little bit. So while they were a little more focused on cuando era niño, me gustaba, and they would mix some things from today in with that, it's great that they're trying. And that's the thing. We have time. And with time, they'll improve and they'll start incorporating those things that we got today. Then they'll start incorporating the things that we'll get next time. And they'll get a little bit better and a little bit better. But it's not going to be an overnight thing where we need to sit down and give them conjugation charts and tables and have them go nuts over that.
Yeah, now I would like to jump back in and add that the whole point with that, from what I'm understanding in my head anyway, is yes, they're learning grammar and grammatical things, but the focus isn't on the grammar.
Right.
The focus is more on what can you do or what are you doing with the language, as opposed to I'm using the past tense. No, I don't care. I'm using the past tense. I'm playing Pictionary. And I'm trying to figure out what they like to do when they were younger. And right. So it's just something it's an implicit.
Yeah. And I see it as teaching phrases and structures as a whole that will have actual specific meaning for them. Any kid can talk about what did you like when you were a kid compared to what do you like now. Anybody can talk about that. So you take a real world scenario and you say, well, here are the phrases that they're going to want to learn. But like you said, Miles, they're going to get the grammar. I mean, or it is teaching it properly, right? It's teaching it effectively, but the focus is the conversation. Focus is just to get them talking or understanding without focusing on these little arbitrary words or grammatical structures.
Yeah, I mentioned it in one of the previous episodes. I tell my students as often as I can that language is not for perfection. Language is for communication. And if you can communicate and the other person can understand you, then that's great. And we can always work and be better at it, but it's communication is the most important thing.
So to finish the first lesson, we played Never Have I Ever, which maybe I should describe a little bit. But Never Have I Ever is a game I learned as a kid where there's a limited number of seats. One person's left without a seat and they go in front or in the middle, whatever your setup is. And then they say, I have never or never have I ever pulled the fire alarm at school, whatever. I guess maybe we don't have fire alarms you can actually physically pull anymore.
You probably wouldn't want to reference that because you might get some.
Yeah. So the person who is in front or in the middle or however your setup is would talk about something that they have never done. They might say, I have never eaten sushi or never have I ever eaten sushi. And everyone who their situation is the opposite. So in this scenario, everyone who had eaten sushi would get up and change seats. And now I have to go find a seat. And the person who's left without a seat goes up front and then they give an example. So we just changed it to when I was a kid, I liked or I didn't like. And if your situation was different or the opposite, you would have to change seats and they would have to run and get in one. And then down the line, we'll just change it to my family, or we can put a variety of different people or things in there. But the skill is going to be translating. They're going to be learning the imperfect past. So just a way that I thought to continue that structure.
Two different activities. So you're circling the same phrases. And that's one thing I think we realize as teachers, we get caught up on activities. Well, I don't have all these different activities. Reality is you can actually recycle a lot of your activities. You just change the phrasing, change the scenario. Not that you should be doing the same thing every single day, but a lot of times we already have the resources we need. You just tweak it a little bit, change what they're supposed to do, change it to a writing one instead of a speaking or something, and students will follow along just fine. So thank you, Roger and Miles, for kind of give us an example of what not to do, what to do. Brandon, do you have any examples of instructional strategies that build toward or promote proficiency that you'd like to add with that?
Yes. Can I start with one thing that I've changed this year that I think has really been a big help? Just a systematic change?
If you must.
Thank you, Davin. Appreciate that. No, seriously, this has really helped me a lot this year. I think it's brought my kids together and kind of created some intrinsic motivation that was needed. And so I just prepared a couple thoughts here about what I've done here. So I think just to be theoretical for a second here, and then we'll get to practical things. I think what we need to do, and we've kind of mentioned this in our first couple episodes, that you've got to build kind of a framework and a system for teaching to proficiency where the kids get to take charge of the conversation of their learning, and they know what proficiency is, how to work the controls a little bit. They know how to ask things like, hey, I got a 4 on this last listening assessment. How can I get that to a 5? You know, they can ask things like that. And I think what happened this year that was really good is I started by having them articulate proficiency goals, even my German 1 kids. And it's really kind of put them in the path here and made everything else that I do in class easier, because I can refer to that and I can say, Billy, you set this goal of getting a 5 by the end of the term on speaking, because last term you got 4s, I don't know, regularly. It's been really nice to refer to that and keep them on that path. So by doing that, and then the proficiencies and the can-dos are really, I have integrated them this year better into the fabric of my whole class than I have in the past. And that's made everything easier. So they know exactly at the beginning of the term, this is what I expect you to be able to do when you're listening to German things, when you're reading German things, when you are speaking about German things or just speaking in German, and when you're writing. And they know that, and they know how to ask questions like, well, what kinds of cohesive devices do I need, or what kinds of topics should I be able to talk about here? And that's pretty clear. Since that's pretty clear to them, I think it makes everything easier in what I do. So as far as instructional strategies that help build towards promoting proficiency, I think building that framework and having your kids eat, drink, and sleep proficiency every day of your class makes it easier. So that's my first theoretical contribution.
If it's all right for me to jump in here, I don't care because I'm going to do it anyway. It makes me think of a perfect example I had today in my classroom. My level 1 classes today, we're reading Pover Ann. Yes, we're already reading Pover Ann, and they don't like it. They complain as much as she does. But no, they're reading Pover Ann, and they're on chapter 3. And in each chapter, I'm kind of giving them different skills, different things to work on. And today, they read through the chapter, and I actually didn't have them read the chapter. They skimmed the chapter and wrote down every single word that they knew, without a doubt. I know this is the word. And they had pretty good lists, and they're at level 1, and a lot of them are cognates, and that's okay. So they wrote down these lists. I had them pass in their book so they couldn't look at their book anymore. And then based on that list and with one partner, based on their lists, they had to rewrite an interpretation of that chapter in English, not in French because they aren't that level yet. But based just on those lists, and they were able to come up with a pretty good description of chapter 3 for Pover Ann. And I pointed out to them that this reading is a skill that you have to work on. And this is one of those skills, is finding what you do know. Don't letting what you don't know drag you down. Find what you do know. use that to try to figure out, do I understand enough to know the plot, what happened, what's going on, not worried about the details, but what's going on. And then, you know, maybe next chapter we'll throw in there, okay, now write down words that you think you know, or go through once writing all the words you know on the first page, and then go back and write words you think you know based on context. So it's just one of those proficiency skills, like you were saying, Brandon, to have that woven into your classroom as part of the instruction. And again, I mentioned it in one of the last episodes, talking about it's okay to take a minute or so to bring those up in your class in English. You got an 85-minute class, and you're supposed to be in target language for 90% of the time. You've got, just quick math, what, 7-8 minutes, if that? But that's a lot of English. Use it and help them understand what proficiency is, so they know where they're trying to get to.
I can tell you that's definitely made a huge difference in my class. So I would agree that that's worth it. And your whole class just looks and feels a bit different. Other strategies I would say that have been helpful is showing my kids examples of good and bad work, I guess. I don't really call it bad, but just below level work. And I'll say, if you want to be here, look, this is kind of a difference between a novice high writer and an intermediate low writer. And we've talked about what that means, but, so those kinds of things. So that's the first thing I would say, just kind of the theoretical part of it is your framework and system has to be a proficiency based system that the kids recognize and feel a part of and know the right words to say, the right questions to ask. So as far as lessons go, I would just say, and this is one thing I'm right in the middle of learning how to do better. I am not a master of this, but just designing lessons that really begin teaching them and training them on the exact things we want to test them on. So we want our teaching to be aligned with what we're assessing them on. If we're assessing them on a skill, then you better be doing an activity where they're learning or practicing a skill. So that's why we say that we need to be careful with grammar, explicit grammar lessons and things like that, because we don't ever ask them, please tell me how to conjugate this verb at the end, because that's...
They didn't ask you to do that when you were in Germany?
Well,
people on the street wouldn't stop you?
You'd be surprised. No, I'm just kidding. No, they don't. They don't. When you're going into the bakery to order, you know, a croissant or something, which they have in Germany as well as France, they don't ask you that. It's do you have the right words to do that? So as they said in the olden days, or as the saying goes, a list of conjugated verbs doth not a cookie make, right? Referring to the cookie that we talked about at the beginning. That's not a skill. It's a skill, but it's not a practical use of the language, which is what we're aiming for. And so that's the other thing I would add in there as far as instructional strategies that build toward and promote proficiency are just activities that are aligned with what we assess, and we assess practical skills.
And I think with that, Brandon, too, we're teaching these kids how to use a language in real world context. So, I mean, the goal is that they walk out of our classroom and they can use the language, going back to the can-do statements, they can do a bunch of things. It actually makes assessing the students a lot easier. Personally, I feel like, because like you said, if we're giving them scenarios to use the language in, like a real life scenario, teaching them how to order food at a restaurant or how to read a restaurant menu, and then you go to test them on something similar to that, they're going to get the assessment and they're like, oh, I've done this before. It's just a different scenario. I know how to talk about food. I know how to talk about health issues. I know how to talk about what I like to do on the weekend or what my friend and I are going to do this summer or whatever it is. So the scenarios might change. You might have different prompts or different suggestions, but like you said, the skill is still there. And some students will have perhaps more vocabulary than others, but they can still score the same. It's the skill of expressing yourself, whatever capacity you could do. And to touch on one other point that Brandon mentioned as well, going back to the things that he shifted, what he changed, because I'm making those same kind of changes as far as giving students ownership of their language proficiency. So we as teachers, we're language coaches. We're trying to get them to the right proficiency level or the targeted proficiency level. My first year, I did too much I do and too much we do, and then very, very little you do. I mean, I did do a significant amount, but the last 2 years I've really focused on that I do should be enough just to model it so they know what it looks like. And then the we do should be pretty significant, but that you do has to be very significant. And that's the hard balance to find. but that you do is so important. The more they practice the language in whatever modality, the better they're going to get at it, right? Just like a sport, playing an instrument, anything else in life. But more importantly than that, the more that they do it, the more ownership they're going to have. The more they're going to have those opportunities to be like, you know, I know how to say these things, but I want to say it like this. And they start being creative with the language. They start breaking it down and decoding it. I'm not sure if that's the right word. But they start making it their own because they've done it so much. It just becomes like a first language in the sense that some things just start coming out naturally. And then you really see that they're playing around with it. They're having fun with it. And that ownership is really important.
Yeah, I just had a thought, Devin, as you were talking. In my head, I got pictured the Actful Pyramid or Upside Down Triangle. So I guess it's not a pyramid. The Upside Down Triangle where, you know, novice is really small and narrow. But as the farther up you get on the pyramid, the wider it gets. In my head, I just see that now as the I do, you do, we do part. The I do is going to be really small and narrow. You're not going to be doing it as much as we do it together. You're going to be doing a little more with the students there. And then the you do is huge. They need a lot of time to practice and get better at it. So in my head, I kind of want to go and draw that now and put it on my website or show it to the students where, and this is one of the things I struggle at, is making sure kind of like you mentioned your first couple of years, the I do and the we do is there. There's plenty of that. There's probably too much, especially the I do part. And it's, so it's hard for me to get away from that. But the we do has to take precedent and has to be much more of the you do needs to be much more evident and much more, there needs to be more of a quantity there. What's the word I'm looking for? More time needs to be devoted to the you do portion.
Right. And that's going to vary level to level. Perhaps your level ones and level twos, there might be more I do time than at the level three or four because they have more of a foundation and more of a base.
And with my level ones, I try to break my class into two segments. So we do an I do, we do, you do during the first half.
Right.
And then my higher levels, I try to do that, but usually what it ends up is it ends up that you do, the we do, you do portion takes up a lot bigger portion. But yeah, my level, lower levels, I'll cut in half kind of. We'll do a quick I do, we do, you do, why do we do, you do. So yeah, I would agree with that as well, that the lower levels, you're going to have a little bit more I do, but the you do, if they're not doing it, they're not going to not learn it. They're not going to acquire the language if they're not doing it.
If they haven't done it enough, they're never going to output it. Yeah. If they haven't output it before in speaking or writing, they're going to do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing that is interesting with that is like you say, we acquire the language through using it and doing it, which means that the students need to be the ones doing it. But I believe it was Daryl Nicolaisen in his training, but it might have been someone else. Anyhow, he had a statistic that said that in whoever the training was from, wherever they were from, the statistic was that students in an average 90-minute class averaged using the language on their own, speaking, writing, whatever. It was somewhere between 30 seconds and a minute and 30 seconds. In an entire class of 80 to 90 minutes.
I want to say that was Daryl Nicolaisen because I vaguely remember that from like the ALA training or.
Yeah, I was pretty sure that's what it was.
And that was shocking. I remember hearing that. And
that's a very small amount of time.
No,
that's like nothing.
Yeah.
It's not going to do him anything.
And in my master's degree program, actually, it was, I can't remember what class it was, but one of the professors from Utah State came down and he, as a prerequisite for the class, each student had to record themselves for a whole class period and then transcribe it and then break down statistically how much this teacher was speaking and how much each student was speaking. And I didn't have that class at that time, so I wasn't involved with that. But it was pretty interesting to see some of the teachers when they found their percentages and say, oh my gosh, I thought I was doing so much better. And so, yeah, things like that, if we could practice something like that, that would be pretty eye-opening, I think, and really start forcing better instructional practices from each of us.
Yeah, and we have to do the I do, especially at the lower levels, like we said, because students have to hear it enough, see it enough in order to reproduce it, right? It's a matter of taking the time to analyze, maybe record your classroom, figure out how much time are you taking that the students then do not have to practice. I want to pose a question to my fellow hosts and just have a discussion. The question, and anybody can start with this, I don't have anybody specific in mind, but the question I'd like to pose is, what is the difference between engaged and fun? So what I mean by that is a lot of times we talk about students should always be engaged. I think sometimes we might confuse that for the word fun. We might think students have to always be having fun. Not that we don't want learning to be fun, but in your guys' classroom, when it comes to teaching language proficiency, what's the difference between language and fun, and what should be the real goal? Should we really be focusing on fun, or should we be focusing on engaged? What are the thoughts on that kind of conversation?
Brandon? Can I start on that?
Yeah.
Okay, so what I think, there are a lot of activities that are super fun, but they would lack, this is just my first thought. This was not a prepared question, by the way. We should let the listeners know that we did not have the question ahead of time. Just off the top of my head, when you asked that question, the difference between fun and engaged, it seems like engaged, there's got to be an element of fun or interest in there, personal interest to the kids, but it's got to be mixed with the sense that you're making progress to your goals. That you can have fun with kind of hollow fun in a classroom where everyone senses that this isn't taking us where we need to go. It's fun, but it's not. They're not engaged in the right task.
Yeah, because as I look at engaged and fun, and I'll give you a scenario. I remember when I was doing screening interviews for school districts at a teacher fair at my university, one of the screening interviews he asked, and I don't remember the question exactly, but he said something like, what do you think about, is it important for a teacher to be liked? And so I remember in education classes, we talked about you're not their buddy, you know, you're their teacher, you're the authoritative figure, not that they shouldn't be comfortable with you, they shouldn't trust you. We talked about those differences. So it kind of threw me for a second. And I thought, is that something that as teachers, we're just shooting for being liked in the classroom? And so as the years have gone on now, and I've thought about it more and more, it would be nice to be liked by the students. We all want to be liked, and we want to think that students enjoy our class. More importantly, they enjoy the language that we're teaching. They enjoy their learning experience. But the goal shouldn't be, do you like me or not? And that's where I bring in the engaged or fun question. I think a lot of times we focus so much on, well, let's make sure it's fun. We want to make sure the students are laughing and doing all this stuff because that means they like school and they like this. Like Brandon said, maybe they just like that activity. And a lot of times we might confuse teaching for entertainment. I'm trying to entertain the kids rather than actually engage them in an activity that's going to be like proficiency-based, something that they're going to use in a real-world or authentic type of scenario.
I would say that kind of like what Brandon said, students aren't stupid, no matter what they say about themselves. They're not stupid. Students are smart enough to know. And I talk to many students like, oh, I love that class. It's really fun, but I don't learn anything. So they're smart enough to know, like Brandon was saying, there's no direction with the fun. And with the liking a teacher, I think that helps to sell your program if students genuinely like you. But even then, yeah, I take the class because I like this teacher, but I feel bad we're not learning anything. I want to actually learn something. So I think yes and no to your whole liking thing. It's good, but it's not. I don't think it's necessary. Right. I think if the students are interested in the subject, it can help. But fun and engaged to me, really, I think it's exactly what Brandon was saying, where you've got to have a direction. They know, are we just having fun for the sake of having fun? Or are we having fun because it leads somewhere? I think they're smart enough to understand that. They're really the difference between engaged. If something's fun, they're going to be engaged, but they're not necessarily learning or acquiring anything.
And I think in my history major, how many papers I had to write as a history major is a lot. Sometimes they were good. Sometimes I enjoyed them. Sometimes I didn't, but I was engaged in all of them because I was trying to improve. Mm-hmm. I knew the subject was important. I knew the practice of expressing opinion, defending reasoning was important. So I was engaged because, yeah, there was a goal. There was a target there that I was striving for. Some of those papers were not fun, though. And I remember some of the books I had to read. Some authors, I just did not enjoy their style of writing. It was not fun to read the book, but I understood why I had to and things like that. So in our high school classrooms, what does that look like, the difference between engaged and fun?
I wonder, and sorry, Roger, you were going to come in here. I wonder then if that's where we talk with our students about the proficiency goals. And I wonder if that helps them be more engaged if something's not fun, if an activity we're doing is kind of boring, but they understand the purpose behind it. It's like, yeah, this might not be a fun activity, but here's the purpose of it. Here's why we're doing this. Like the example I gave earlier where they had to write down all of the words they knew from that chapter 3. They didn't like that. They thought it was stupid. But as soon as we were done and I took the books away from them and they had to decide what that chapter was about and I explained the skill of reading and how you have to work on that, I saw not all of my students, but a couple of handfuls of them are like, oh, so that makes good sense. I like that.
Yeah. So like in my class, I'm a big fan of games for learning. I like to do a lot of activities where the kids are up and running or doing things that they find really, I would use the term entertaining. But I know that I can pull from that. What are they learning? So if I want to see how much of the vocabulary that we've done to this point of the term, or do they really have down, I'll throw up a whole bunch of images or GIFs on the screen that are the exact same images or GIFs that I use to introduce a vocabulary word and repeat that throughout the term. Now I'll just throw up all these images onto the screen, give each team a marker, and say, I'm going to time you for 1 minute, ready, go. And they'll run up there and just start writing down the vocab words. And they have a lot of fun, but I can see, okay, they are retaining the vocabulary. And that is more of a what do you know? But they're getting so much practice with what can they do with the language, incorporating that vocabulary, that I feel like it balances out. And there are a lot of other games that I like to do. And I was trying to explain some of these to my student teacher. He'd watch the kids do them, and he just said something like, well, that's a cute activity. And I thought, but man, look how much they showed us of what they know. And it was kind of like you had a hard time seeing what I could see. They just used past tense a whole lot in that game or that activity, or we did this and now they're using that structure that we used. They're going to use that tomorrow, guarantee it. Or they're going to use it down the line. Or they're going to tweak it because they're able to see they've done this game, this activity enough times that they can start to see the application into other people and not just me. But like we say, the difference between entertaining and engaging, sometimes I do have to stop the kids and say, okay, we're kind of getting away from the purpose. What my goal is, like, look at what you've done, and I'll, you know, hopefully we have something up on the board to demonstrate physically that they can see how far they've come. That's really cool with level ones, where, you know, if they're writing something on the board, you can say, like, look at all this stuff you've learned in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, however long, to be able to show them. So sometimes you do need to step in there and temper things, but a lot of fun and entertaining activities can be very, very effective.
Yeah, and I would agree with that too. Fun for me would be more a byproduct or a consequence of a really well thought out engagement activity that focuses on proficiency. And what I've seen with most students, the more that they've realized that they're learning and can use the language, the more fun that they do have. That's not to say they love class every day. That's not to say every time I tell them we're doing a listening comprehension, they hate those. They moan and groan every single time, but they do them because they know it's important. They know they'll never get it without the practice. And they know as they get better, they seem to settle in a lot more in the classroom. So I look at it would be great if every day was fun, everything was good, but the focus should be engaging the students in proficiency type activities and focus on that as a classroom. It's a lot easier to get the kids to be engaged that way and to have fun and be entertained as well. That shouldn't be the focus, is the entertainment and the fun. But I thank you for joining us and listening in. Hopefully you were able to get some teaching strategies, some instructional strategies, or hopefully we gave you some confidence as we shared what we've struggled with. Maybe now you realize you're not doing so bad. We want to challenge you on two things. Number one is don't be afraid to try whatever new thing that you want to do. Always give something a chance as long as you're focused on the students and as long as you're focused on proficiency and getting them to hit the actual standard so they can actually use the language outside of your classroom. Give it a shot. Try something new. Don't be afraid that it's gonna fall flat and absolutely fail. As Miles always said, that just means you can fail better next time. Do you guys have any comments on that one?
It makes me think back to the start of the 2016-17 school year when we had our welcome back to the school year meeting at Boondocks, and I was asked to teach a portion. As we had teachers rotate from table to table and have different stations, and in mine I talked about the monkey's dilemma, which is where the scientists had a peanut in a jar and the hole was just big enough for the monkey's hand. So the monkey put his hand in there, grabbed the food, goes to pull it out and can't get it with a fist. They had to let go. They had to let go of something. And when I heard that, it wasn't even education related, but when I heard about that, I just thought, oh my heck, there are some things that I do in my classroom that I just need to let go of and that I can try to do different things. And That was one thing I learned when I was a student teacher, was to try new things and not to be afraid, because you might fall on your face. You might fall on your face embarrassingly in front of the students, but it's okay, because they'll see that you're human, and as long as you can laugh and tell the kids that, like, hey, that really kind of stunk, but next time it'll be better. Just being willing to try new things is really good. Again, it just helps the students see that you're a normal person just like they are. And then hopefully they're a little more willing to try and fail and fall on their face in front of you.
Yeah, and last point we'd like to mention, as Roger already said, be willing to never do it again. A lot of times it takes a lot of risk to try something new, but you kind of always have to. You always find ways to improve as you're teaching. But one of the biggest things, like Roger says, we have to be willing to let go. If something's just not working, or it's not as effective because we've learned new practices or better practices, or just the way education shifts and changes for the betterment of the students, be willing to never do something again and to move on completely and leave it behind and focus on the students. With that, we thank you for joining us on this Level Up podcast. And I'm going to say adios.
Hasta luego.
A plus. Auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you for getting down with Level Up.